الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين حبيب قلوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا أبي القاسم محمد وعلى أهل البيت يبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين ولعن الله أعداءهم أجمعين إلى يوم الدين أما بعد فقد قال الله وقوله الحق بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم ليس للإنسان إلا ما سعى صلوات على محمد وعلى محمد I need a better salawat than that, please. Thank you. Thank you. Balancing this dunya and the akhirat has been our topic, and tonight is lecture number 3. We have thus far looked at aspects that are only exclusive to dunya so far. We will resume that discussion today. Tomorrow being Wednesday and Thursday, we will look at aspects that are specific to the hereafter, and then Friday, Saturday, Sunday, which is our last 3 lectures, we'll look at how to balance these 2 worlds out. When we introduced a topic on Sunday, we talked about how right now there's a difficulty amongst our youth and maybe amongst our adults as well to find out how much of the dunya should we be involved in and how much of the akhirah should we live for. Some individuals, like I said before, are so deep in the dunya, they neglect the akhirah. And some are so deep in the akhirah, they neglect this world. Both approaches are wrong. There are extremes in Islam. We don't accept those extremes. What we do accept is a balance. When Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salatu wassalam wa'ajjil farajahum in Nahj al-Balagha talks about this balance when he speaks about the idea of living for this world as if you are to live for 100 years. And in the same breath he says living for the hereafter as if you are to die tomorrow. Talking about a balance, a moderation between these 2 extremes. It's a very difficult task, it's not easy. But we spent a good portion in yesterday's discussion talking about the importance of struggle and effort and mehnat on the path of Islam, really on the path of anything in your life. If you want to be successful in this world, you have to start from this age right now when you guys are all in school to work hard and get good grades and study hard and build those blocks where later on when you're 30, 40, 50, inshallah, you're reaping those benefits. Today we look at 3 more aspects that are exclusive to the dunya. The very first one I want to share, a small saying of wisdom by Luqman. Luqman, as many of you know, is not a prophet of Allah's, but is a man who was granted immense wisdom and holds a high station in the eyes of Allah, such that there's a whole surah named after him in the Quran. When Luqman was advising his son of a series of advices, and when he turned to this topic about the dunya and the akhirah, he said to my son, if you sell this dunya for the akhirah, you will gain both of them. But if you sell the hereafter for this dunya, you will lose both of them. It's a very beautiful piece of advice. Those of us who want to be successful in this world, and when I say success, I mean the materialistic success that we want, the comforts that money gives us, the lifestyle it brings for us, there's nothing wrong with that. One salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Luqman's talking about the concept of investment in Islam. Investing in Islam. Let me very briefly speak about investment a little bit. For those of you who are in the investing fields, mutual funds, stock, etc. You know that in investments, however much you put in initially, that's how much your ROI is going to be at the end of the day. For example, if you invest on a monthly basis and you invest $10 a month, let's say, in something, your return on investment at the end will be based on how much you put inside each month. You put $10, your buddy puts $110, let's say, for example. His return will be higher than yours. Why? His initial investment was higher. Makes sense. So when playing with money, for example, and investing in money, for example, we're talking about investment here only, however much you put in, you get that much out. Education is the exact same way. Right now, if your professor or your teacher says, look, if you can do this amount of homework, you'll be able to cover the basics of the class, you decide to do 10% more. Why? You want to be a little bit above the rest. You want to put forth the effort now so that later on, like I said, when you're in the professional fields, you are cut above the rest in that field as well. So what do? You spend long nights, you spend hours and hours, you sacrifice your TV time, your internet time, everything, just to make sure that you are on top of your school. You invest. My students in university right now who are just finished writing exams and you guys are enjoying your days off right now, in terms of investment of the education system, it's very similar. You spend all night preparing yourself for an exam, you write the exam, and you ace it. And you feel great about yourself. And you get a mark that says, I don't know, A plus or 91 or 94, whatever the case may be, a mark that you are fairly proud of. No one's going to mail you a check of X amount of dollars for studying all night or for writing you a check. Writing the exam. What you will feel is a sense that, you know what, I'm investing in my future. So we will, for 17, 18, sometimes 25 years of our life in school that we spend, invest hours upon hours, sacrifice our sleep and our food, just to make sure that not now, 10, 15 years from now, we'll be set. Even if you were to initially, let's say if you're an accountant right now in the field, if you initially were to come out of school and you were to get a job with a big accounting firm, Deloitte or KPMG or other big accounting firms, you wouldn't obviously start off at the top. In fact, very basic entry-level accounting jobs are pretty insignificant. They're minute. They're boring. And you think to yourself, wait a second, I worked that hard to get this job? I'm organizing files and I'm doing God knows what and just stuff that's really petty for you. But again, you don't leave the company, you still invest your time in that company. You still work your 10 hours. If your boss tells you to stick around and help me staple these things, you stick around and help them staple. Thinking and knowing full well that maybe 4 or 5 years from now, as I build up in the company, he'll remember those days that I invested my time with him, and he'll give me a good position. When it comes to our kids, our parents nowadays are so concerned about our kids in this society, and well you should be. It's a very dangerous society out there. So some parents are very proactive. They put time and time and time in their kids. One parent leaves their job to stay home with the kids. The parents struggle to survive on one income, but they do it why? Because they want their kids to grow up to be somebody who's a pious individual, a righteous individual, a successful individual. The point I'm trying to make is that the tools of investment are inside every one of us. We invest in everything that we do. And we know that the return on the investment won't come maybe sometimes for years upon years. But we're still willing to invest at that moment. We know that right now the job that I'm at may not be the best job that I want, but right now if I just kind of stick it through, I could be somebody in 4 or 5 years. In every other aspect of our life, we invest knowing full well, like I said again, 3 times now, the return on the investment might come years later, But when it comes to our deen and our religion and our faith, we invest, let's say, our time. We want that return on investment instantly. We want that dua answered by the time I'm done folding my janamas. We want that check in the mail by the time I'm done closing my hands for dua. We want that health from the sickness before I'm done reading the dua books. For some reason, we don't apply the same tools and rules of investment for Islam that we do for everything else that we invest in. It's the exact same principle. It's the exact same tools. It's the same rules. The amount that you put in today, now, in this dunya, you'll see that exact amount in the hereafter. If you start to invest in your deen from now, little by little, you'll start to see actually the effects of it in this dunya. We believe Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gives you a small hint, a preview, a glance, a glimpse of reward and punishment in this world. And so you'll see sometimes, if sometimes your risk goes all the way up, alhamdulillah, where you're making good coin, mashallah, and all of a sudden your boss calls you and says, we're outsourcing to India, and you're out of a job. And so all the way, your risk is all the way down here. This fluctuation of the rewards of Allah is reward and punishment. It's called mujassami a'mal inside of our books. And so the point I'm trying to make is that this dunya is all about investment. If you get your return in this dunya, so be it. But none of us should expect that our complete ROI of our investment of our deen happens in this world. It happens in the next. The same idea, none of my kids going to university and school right now would expect to have any sort of return on their investment in schooling now. Those who are 21, 22 in the audience right now, you're working so hard to get good grades. You're getting good grades so you can be rich when you're 40. That's 20 years from where you are right now. But you're still willing to invest. When it comes to our deen, it's zero, unfortunately. Or it's bare minimum. Right? So again, the rule is what? You put in that amount, you'll get that amount at the end. You put in 10 days of Muharram all throughout the year, and you think you've done a grand service to Imam Hussein, you'll get those 10 days of 365 days in the hereafter. And when you complain to Imam Hussein, I came to your masjid for 10 days. That's all I get. Is this whatever you get? He'll say, you came for 10 days. Did you change yourself in 10 days? Did you understand why I went to Karbala? Did you sacrifice for Allah the way I sacrificed for Allah? Did you submit to Allah the way I submitted to Allah? Did you elevate your family the way I elevated my family when my 6-month-old Ali Asghar submitted his life for me? Right? So investment in this dunya. That's why when a person was in front of our fifth imam, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salatu wasalam, and our fifth imam, the books say, overheard him praying for a fast death. This individual wanted to die very quickly. Our imam got upset. Says, don't ever pray to leave this world too quickly. As much as you can, benefit from this world and gain Allah's mercy from this world. Because the moment your books in this world is closed, that's it. Your amal is done, your hisab starts. We are in this dunya, and hadith says sometimes for 1 hour, it seems. Let's get what we want from this dunya and let's leave. Right? The hadith says that al-dunya darul munafiqeen. It's the abode for the hypocrites. Lastu bidarul muttaqeen. It's not the abode for the pious. The first day I said, and I'll say it almost every day, our fundamental problem is that we expect from the dunya that which it will not give us. We expect sukoon and itminan in this world. It's not going to give it to you. We expect comfort in this world. It's not going to give it to you. We expect a life that has no trials, no hardships. Not going to give it to you. We'll even pack up our bags and fly somewhere else, as if the dunya is located in one area of this globe. I'm telling you, it's not. A lot of my parents come to me and say, I said, we want to go back to Pakistan. We don't go back to India. What if I settle my kids in Iran? Is that a better life for them? I said, look, the dunya is everywhere. The dunya has very certain specifications, has a very certain features. You can fly anywhere you want to. The dunya won't change its face. The problems you face here, you'll face there as well. If I told you some of the issues of the youth of Iran, who are Irani, you might be shocked. And the Pakistan situation, all of you are fully aware. It's not like East and West are East and West anymore. It's become one global village, as all of you know. A Pakistani youth at 21 is facing pretty much the same issues that a 21-year-old Canadian is in today's society. It's nothing different. The point I'm trying to make is that we are expecting comfort. And when this dunya does not give us comfort, we try to look for a corner somewhere we can sit and just sukoon aram se sit, and that's not going to happen. The faster we realize that, the faster we begin to be more comfortable in this dunya and begin to prepare for the next, inshallah. One salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. As you all know, I've been fighting a severe infection for 3 days. The infection is going, but it's taking my voice with it, unfortunately. I'm not sure what happened there. So I lost half of my voice this morning. So inshallah, all of you can hear me okay in the back, inshallah. One salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. The power of investment. The power of investment. Islam places a huge emphasis on investing for your akhirah. Begin to build your palace, because that's where your asli in zindagi is. That's where your asli life is. You and I, the Prophet of Allah says, you and I were not built for this world. We were built for an eternity. We were built for an eternity, not for 65 years, and if you're lucky, not for 105 years. We were built for an eternity. Now, how you and I live in that eternity is in our hands, ultimately. That's why a subtopic of investment is decision making. Making good, clear decisions. And again, I'll use the idea that we do it for everything else, but when it comes to our deen. If you want to buy a house in some area, we'll call, if we know a few guys in the area, we'll call a few guys in the area and say, look, how is this area? How are the homes? They have good walls, strong walls, it's a good area, the crime rate. Are there shopping plazas there, gas stations, restaurants there, schools there? We'll do our research. We want to apply for university, we'll ask around. Is Ryerson good? How's York's program? What about UFT? We'll do our proper research. We'll dig deep. We want to marry somebody, we'll ask everybody who knows that individual in that family. Hey, are they okay? Are they all right? Are there any issues? But when it comes to our religion, when it comes to fighting our shaitan, our decision-making skills are nowhere. So one of the aspects of Karbala, and really this requires a whole topic, the aspects of Karbala, is that Imam Hussein recognized his enemy, who his external enemy was, and who the internal enemy was. And he left the comforts of his Medina and took 200 kids with him on this extremely long journey just to face his enemy. And he sacrificed every drop of blood he had inside of him just to make the world aware what his enemy is truly all about. Nobody here is asking any of us to sacrifice our heads. No one's asking you to take an arrow to the chest. No one's asking you to take a spear to your forehead. No one's asking you to do that. But what they are asking you to do is to recognize your enemy within you. And fight that enemy. And you fight that enemy through making good decisions. Not going where you need to fight Shaitan. We surround ourselves with Shaitan and we expect for a moment that we are strong enough to fight Shaitan. It's like that saying that you go to a blacksmith, you stand outside the blacksmith window, you don't even go inside. You go home and you see your hands are black. It's the effect and the asar sometimes of your environment. Right? And a lot of times the youth, sometimes when I hear about the problems of our community, I think to myself, they're smart individuals. They're reasonable, logical individuals. They're straight A students making dumb decisions with their social life. Choosing friends on Friday nights that are just a bunch of bozos that have no direction in life. And you not having the courage to say, look guys, you guys are going there Friday night? I'm not interested. We don't have the courage to do that. If you do, you're special. Majority of us are followers. Wherever the crowd goes, we'll go with them. It doesn't matter if inside of your hearts of hearts you know, I shouldn't be here. But I don't have the courage to say, you know what guys, I'm leaving. So instead of doing that, don't put yourself in that position to begin with. Because Shaitan is not one, he has shayateen. There are many Shaitans. Identifying who your Shaitan is the key. Every individual in this room has its own Shaitan. You have your own individual Shaitan who pulls you off the path. Some people, like I said before, some people have music as their Shaitan. Some people have haram food. Some have opposite genders. Some have gossip and backbiting. Some have dance parties. Some have mixed weddings. Whatever the case may be, whatever your Shaitan is, whatever pulls you off that path, recognize it. Because that's exactly how Shaitan works. Shaitan sees, okay, let me try a song with this individual, puts a song on, no reaction, he crosses off music from your list. And he keeps going down that list until he recognizes what is that one vice that's going to pull him off the path of Allah. Once he's circled that, he dangles that in front of you time and time and time again. And uses that to pull you off the path. Islam says before Shaitan recognizes that inside of you, you recognize that inside of you and learn to fight it. And we do that through good decision making. We do that through investment in this dunya. That's why the base of our discussion has been the Prophet's hadith. Well, one dunya is that dunya that you can attain success from, and one dunya is that dunya that's cursed, it's mal'oon. The dunya that you can attain success from for the hereafter is this idea of investment and good decision making and beginning to plant the grounds and the fields for your hereafter. One salawat ala Muhammad wa ala. Because I mentioned that if we don't do this, then that cursed dunya starts to trickle into our system. And we have countless hadith that talks about this contradiction between the dunya and the hereafter. And that dunya that you read and that you hear about on this member being a disgusting place, that dunya being a woman with blue eyes that Mawla Ali divorced several times, that's the cursed dunya. That's the one where Mawla Ali says the bitterness of this world is the sweetness of the hereafter. And the sweetness of this world is the bitterness of the hereafter. It's a beautiful, beautiful statement. But he's painting a picture of complete opposites. You can't have your sweetness here and your sweetness there. You have to choose literally to make one place just a mode of you getting through, knowing full well, if I get through this without attaching myself to this world, I know there's a paradise waiting for me on that side of this world, inshallah. That's why point number two in today's discussion talks about zuhud. What does it mean to be a zahid in Islam? To be somebody who is an abstainer, somebody who is performing abstinence. Does it mean that we shouldn't be rich? Does it mean that we shouldn't drive nice cars? Does it mean that we shouldn't have that beautiful house? No, of course not. Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salatu wa salam. He says just this, he says, Zuhud is not this concept of not attaining wealth in this world. The practice of Zuhud in Islam is not attaching yourself to that wealth that you have possessed. Not attaching yourself with these worldly benefits in this world. That if you are to leave this world, it would be very difficult to pry you away from this world. It's such an important trait that we know that when, if you were ever to study the philosophy of Imamat and why the school thought of the Ahlul Bayt places such a high emphasis on this idea of the leadership after the death of the Holy Prophet, you know that one of the discussions of Imamat are the characteristics and the sifats that an Imam must have. And this is where us and our Sunni brothers differ, of course. Their version of a Khalifa is one way, our version of a Khalifa is another. The very first trait that we believe the leader after the Prophet should have is Ismat, infallibility. Another one is Ilm al-Ludunni, knowledge of this world and the next. One of them that perhaps isn't discussed enough is Zuhud as well. An imam is not an imam unless he has zuhud, unless he himself is a zahid, one who doesn't attach or cling himself to anything that he owns in this world. Now how do you do that is the question. I have a nice car, I'm making good coin, I have a great job, I worked hard for it, I studied hard for it. Nothing wrong with that, mashallah, it's fine. If it's halal, go crazy, enjoy it, it's your world. But how do I not attach myself to this world? Because as one of my teachers would say in the Hawza, the last thing I ever want to be is the most richest dead person in the cemetery. At that moment, it doesn't matter, right? So they say that if you take worldly things, materialistic things, and you add righteousness to them, I'll give an example, then that makes it something where you are no longer attached to it. At the same time now, you've made these materialistic benefits of yours avenues for success in the hereafter. The Quran says very famously, يَوْمَ لَا يَنْفَعُ مَالٌ وَلَا بَنُونَ. Your property and your children, the two things that we work hardest for, will not benefit you in the hereafter. They won't benefit you at all. Except when you attach righteousness to these two aspects. Let me give you an example. You have been blessed, mashallah, with a lot of money. A local center comes to you looking for donations. And you give them whatever you can. You've taken your mal, you've taken your property, your money that you have worked so hard for, and that's so near and dear to you, you've attached the righteousness to it, and you've given it towards a cause. We have a very beautiful hadith, by the way, on charity, I want to share with all of you. I don't remember who the imam is, one of the masumin. Says that when you give charity, and the picture that they paint for you is like this, when you take money out and you give it towards charity, that money, literally it says, turns around and begins to talk to you, and says three things to you. It says that I was insignificant, you made me significant by this act. I was diminishing, you gave me eternal value with this act. You safeguarded me in this world, I will safeguard you in the hereafter. It's such a beautiful hadith. That's what I mean by taking this money that has such a negative connotation in our minds, such a black cloud over the word money, and using it for good to the point where now you enjoy it and the Muslim Ummah enjoys it. And that dollar that you have given in the way of Allah, you'll see tenfold the hereafter. It's the best of both worlds. It's balancing both worlds. We're talking about that for the past 3 nights now. You're taking this property of yours, and now you're mixing righteousness in it, and you present it. And now everybody around you is happy. The same idea with your children. You have children, and if you have raised your children properly to be individuals who are God-fearing and pious individuals, then whether you are here or you're not here, a cut of what they do is for you. I asked one of my teachers, I said, look, when I go somewhere, I used to go to Masjid a lot when we were in Iran, or whenever I try to do something good, my niyat is always to send everything to my father. That's my niyat. Not a percentage of it, I want 100% sent to my father. I said, what does that mean about my books? Should I get someone else to cover my deeds, etc.? He says, Asad, when you have that niyat for your father, but because you're doing that act, he said, you get 100% and your father gets 100%. But because you are the doer of that act, you are the one giving that charity, you are the one that is earning that money, you're the one that is sacrificing that money. And similarly, you're the one that's raising that child. You're the one that's feeding that child. You're the one nourishing that child. You're the one putting that child in that van and bringing him here, or bringing him to madrasa, or taking him elsewhere. So yeah, if that child grows up to be somebody who is God-fearing, on the path of Islam, submissive and sincere, then yes, absolutely. Now, where this child may not be of any benefit to you in the hereafter, all of a sudden now has become a source of your salvation in the hereafter, inshallah. Why? You've attached a righteousness to this child. One salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. So let's do our best. We have to understand, to number one, invest in the akhirah. We invest in property here, we buy multiple homes, we put them up for rent, we flip them, we do all those things in this world. I'm saying, use a little bit of that talent for the hereafter as well. Don't neglect your akhirah. That's where your final abode will be. That's where an eternity will be. And within that discussion to my youth, especially guys, make good decisions with your life. Stop and think for a moment. Build that willpower inside of you to not be followers, but be leaders. We are the followers of the greatest leaders of mankind. We need to adopt that leadership inside of us. And secondly, is this idea of being Zahids in our community. Don't attach yourself to this dunya. Don't attach yourself to what you have. Enjoy it, use it, benefit from it, but don't cling to it. Where if your car gets totaled, that's it for 3 days now. You haven't shaved, you haven't eaten, you haven't slept. Leave me alone. My car is gone. Or if my sisters lose their Louis Vuitton purse somewhere in the mall, or their coach purse in the mall, then that's it. Wa vayla, wa vayla. No, it's not like that. It's not like that. Right? So I want you to create a very fine line between enjoying your worldly benefits and attaching yourself to those benefits. That's why when we look at prioritizing our lives and managing our time, our Ahlul Bayt tell us that our day should be broken up into four parts, as many of you know. One part should be for your rest, for your sleep. One part should be for your profession, which also includes your school or profession. One portion should be for Allah's ibadat, And the fourth one should be for halal pleasures. Be it the pleasures that you have, or be it your family, or be it you and your spouse, or be it you and your children, or family time, whatever. Per day, a small portion where it's just you and your family, if possible. But the amount of management that Islam talks about, managing your accounts, managing your time, managing yourself, managing your anger, managing your nafs, managing your desires. It's all about management in Islam. And that comes from a concrete system of decision-making skills. And the funny thing is that everywhere else in our life we do it. We don't do it for our deen for some reason. So it's not like we don't know how to do it. I'm saying take those skills and divert them towards a religion. That's when you'll start to see that yes, I have this world, and now I've also begun to prepare for the next as well. One salawat ala Muhammad. Because where we fault in is that we don't manage our time effectively. We put all of our time into one portion of those four slots. So instead of working maybe 8 hours at work, if we own our own business, we'll be there for 14 hours. Instead of sleeping a good 5-6 hours at night, we'll sleep 3 hours at night. Instead of worshiping Allah for 1/4 of the day, we don't have time where to the point we pray Salat so fast that our wudu isn't even dry yet. That's how fast our prayer is sometimes. We don't have time, that's why. We don't have time. That's why the hadith about this one also says that if you neglect one area of the four, the other three get affected. The other three get affected. You don't sleep properly, your work gets affected. You don't work properly, your wife gets affected. You have a horrible day at work and she gets the brunt of it, bichadi. You don't worship Allah properly, then your risk doesn't come. I mean, it's all interconnected. So we have to learn to live our life balanced and manage our time. And that happens in this dunya, in this world. We're only here for a handful of days. Right? And we have this guarantee, I don't know from where, that this world and this life is going to be at least until I'm 80 or 90. You and I have buried 18-year-olds. You and I have buried 21-year-olds. You and I have seen people who should have lived longer and didn't. And we still have the audacity, we all do, have the audacity to somehow have this guarantee of life. We don't. We've heard about people who've gone to sleep and never woken up. We've heard about people who have left this center, let's say, or any center, that one night. Within half an hour, you get a call, he passed away. On a personal note, I don't ever get personal, but I try not to. But the night that my father passed away, he left the center at Al-Mahdi at 11:30, and at 12 o'clock, he passed away. When I told people that same night, the thing that they said to me was that I can still feel the warmth of his hand when he said Khulafis to me. That's how much of a guarantee we don't have in this world. So when you don't have that guarantee, you seize the moment, right? Carpe diem, as they say. You seize the moment. You live your moments like it's your last. You pray your salat like it's your last. But it doesn't mean you neglect everything else in your dunya. If you wake up tomorrow morning, inshallah, you go to work. So all these aspects need to be discussed in thorough detail. And they're all reminders, by the way. All of us, mashallah, know this. And you've heard it from several people on this member far more qualified than I am. It's simple reminders. We are ghafil human beings. We are heedless. We forget. We'll sit in a majlis and we'll think, wow, what a majlis. It blew me away. It's going to change my life. And the moment you get from that door to the car door, you forget everything that was said. That's how we are. That's why 5 times a day, Iyaka na'budu. In fact, 10 times a day. We remind ourselves that you alone we worship, you alone we ask for help. A lot of my youth ask me, I don't get it. Surah Al-Hamd in every single namaz, the same surah, the same namaz, isn't it a little repetitive? And the example my teacher gave me, I'll share with you, inshallah. One salawat ala Muhammad wa ala. My teacher says that about this issue about repetition sometimes over and over and over again, the same thing. He says that, I want you to imagine those who have flown on a plane. One salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. So the example I'll give you is that, for example, I'll be flying to Miami next week, for example, to a center in Miami. And the way that my flight is, that I fly from Toronto to Boston, Boston to Miami, that's my flight. I'll board the plane in Toronto, and then they'll begin to tell me what? The safety features. They will tell me how to buckle a seatbelt together. They'll tell me that you take this part, and this part, and you do this. And when it clicks, it's on. Like I'm 3 years old. Then they'll tell me, if you lift this up like this and you pull it apart, it comes out. And then they'll tell me that if the cabin pressure in the plane drops, a mask will come on, and they'll tell me how to put the mask on. Take the elastic and put it around your head, then pull these two to make it tight. They actually have a video and a woman doing it, and they're spending lots of money on it. I land in Boston, I take off for Boston, from Boston to Miami. The exact same video is on. They tell me how to buckle my seatbelt. They tell me how to put on an oxygen mask. They tell me how to put on a life vest. They tell me to follow the lights towards the exit doors. They tell me all these things. I'm like, look, don't tell me these things. If I want to know something, I want to know what's being served for food on the plane. What movie is being shown? How long has a pilot flown this plane for? Is he even an experienced pilot? Where are the bathrooms? The toilets flush? These are things that are important to me. They'll come back and tell me that we tell you these things over and over and over again because of your own safety. Because of your own salvation. Because if ever you were in trouble, you would know exactly what to do. If ever you were lost, you know exactly who to turn to. If ever this were to happen, you know exactly what to do. 10 times a day, Maliki Yawmiddin. Over and over and over again, we tell ourselves that if ever I'm lost, I know who to turn to. If ever I need help, I know who to turn to. If ever I need guidance, I know which path to go to. I know which path I want, I know which path I don't want. غَيْرِ مَغْضُوبِ عَلَيْهِ. We don't want that path. So this idea is not about repetition, it's about what? Reminding us. We are, like I said, people who sleep in the khab of ghaflat. One salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Just a small reminder that yesterday there was a lunar eclipse, I believe, that was visible in North America. If you have not performed namaz ayat, that is wajib, you may do so today. The tartib of it should be online in several areas. One salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. That's why when you look at this tragedy of Karbala, you see that after everything that Bibi Zainab saw with her eyes, her one famous statement was, "Ma araytu minhum illa jamila," that all I saw was nothing but beauty. All I saw was nothing but beauty. The same Zainab who stood on Tilla Zainabiyah. The same Bibi Zainab who, when Ono Muhammad fell from their horse and Imam Hussein, Hazrat Abbas, brought them back to the Khaymagah, every single woman came out to mourn and cry for these two young soldiers, except for one woman. Except for one woman. And they all waited to see Bibi Zainab's reaction. So everybody waited as the tents opened. The same Bibi Zainab walked out, stood beside the two bodies of her sons lying there on the plains of Karbala. She kneeled down between these two sons. She put one hand on the chest of Aun. She put one hand on the chest of Muhammad. She went down to sajda and she said, "Allah, accept this small hadiyah on my behalf." This was the same Zainab who saw nothing but beauty, she said in Karbala. The same Zainab that Asr-e Ashur, when Imam Hussein is time and time again calling out to his valiant warriors, "Ey Habib ibn Mazahir, Ya Zuhair ibn Qayn, Ya Qasim, Ya Ali Akbar, Ya Aun Muhammad, where are you? Why aren't you answering my call? This is the Imam of your time asking you. This is your Mawla Hussein calling you. Why are you not replying to my call?" And when it was time for Imam Hussein to mount his horse, they say he looked left and he looked right. He looked right and he looked left. He looked everywhere. He didn't see anybody. It was this same Zainab who walked out of the tents and said, "Bhaiya, I will help you mount your horse. I will help you mount your horse." The same Zainab who, when it was time for her to leave Karbala and Umm Kulsum and Zainab were left after mounting child after child after child, Umm Kulsum says, "Bibi Zainab, I will mount you on the horse." Bibi Zainab says, "No, Umm Kulsum, I will mount you on the horse." And I have no doubt that Bibi Zainab for a moment thought to herself that on the 28th of Rajab, when I left Medina, I came out of my home. In front of me was Ali Akbar. On my left was Abbas. In front of me was Hussein. All three of them helped me mount my horse. But today, as she is there alone, she turns towards the banks of Furat and says, "Abbas, this Zainab of yours is mounting her horse alone. How is it possible that I have a brother like Abbas? This Zainab is completely alone." سيعلم الذين ظلموا أي من قلب ينقلبون إنا لله وإنا إليه راجعون. مات من حسين. يا حسين
يا حسين
يا حسين
يا حسين
يا حسين
يا حسين يا حسين يا حسين يا حسين يا حسين يا حسين يا حسين يا حسين يا حسين يا حسين يا حسين يا حسين يا حسين يا حسين